Were you just bragging to me about how much money you were making at the university here?
Yeah, you can sit over here. Unless I put the laser designator on you. So I'm trying to think if I have any other good stories to tell. That was the time you showed up in Switzerland for another meeting, right? And you had no place to stay. You ended up staying in that French farmhouse. Did that work out?
It's great. It's very expensive.
You sure it was a farmhouse?
Was it yes.
Okay.
Graduate students with me there.
Oh, that's right, you did. But that was Joe Bob, right?
Joe Bob.
The rest of the farm, right? Yeah.
I think we've got about a quorum here. I'm just going to say a few words because I'm losing my voice here. I'm happy to introduce Professor Ed Bell. I'm surprised and very pleasure to have come down here, not just because he's such an old friend, but because he's an incredibly enthusiastic guy. He's literally full of it. I mean, he's filled with research, and he's filled with stories, and they really are funny. So they're not true.
At least the ones about you.
The other ones I can't vouch for. definitely this will be an entertaining and a very informative talk. Ed has been around for a very long time, and because of that, he's accumulated, like dust, a number of honors and awards. See, you're supposed to say laugh now.
I know.
He's been at producing when? It was like
1984.
84. Oh, that's supposed to be.
Not 1948.
That's where he is now a chair professor. He holds the Silicon Valley Professor of Electrical Engineering and Biomedical Engineering. He researches interests include everything. He's published several thousand papers.
Not quite that many. Not as many as you.
Oh, yes. let me just get that.
Thank you. Okay. So, thanks. It's always good to come down and see my friends and colleagues down here. Some of the things I'm going to talk about today, if you want to find out more information, you can either send me an email or you can go to visit my website and download some of my papers. I'm actually recording the talk. I'll give a copy of the slides to Brian. I'll convert my talk into an MP3 file and give you that, and then you can, because there was a couple students this morning that couldn't attend because they had class, so I offered to record it. So I'm going to talk today about multimedia security. I'm going to talk about some of the problems associated with multimedia security, maybe contrast it with some of the issues having to do with more typical data security. Of course, one of the problems that's driving multimedia security is that everything is digital these days. So you have digital audio, you have digital video, you have digital images. And a copy of a digital media element is identical to the original. This is far different than in the days where, let's say, if you took a videotape, an analog videotape, you get a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, you would get what is referred to as generation loss. As you kept on making those copies of the copies, slowly the signal-to-noise ratio would go down, and the signal would be suffering from noise, and it would be lower quality. Of course, you can take an MP3 file, make a copy of an MP3 file, and that's identical to the original. So there are some problems associated with that. So the problem is, how can an owner protect their content? And I really should have another slide here that also says, what kind of rights do users have in this digital world as far as being able to do something with that content? There also is issues about whether historians will be able to think of images as being fossilized life. One of the things that in the past, some historians have argued that photographs were fossilized life. Now, photographs have always been able to be faked. However, it's easy to do now. As a matter of fact, all of you who have maybe taken any signal processing course at UT can easily fake photographs. Okay? And so I actually collect faked digital photographs, and I have a collection of over 4,000 images of fake scenes. Maybe I can show you some of those towards the end. The problem is going to be is that since it's so easy to change things,
It's going to be problems in some cases going to be documenting what people have done in the past. There's also this issue is what does it mean in terms of law? I mean, if I go out and buy a book, that book has a copyright associated with it. And there are some laws that have developed over the last 200 years that describe what I can do with that book. Okay? You know, I can buy a book and I can give it to somebody else or I can sell it to somebody else. But what does it mean, really, to own bits? You know, can you own a bucket of bits? And what are your rights if you're the creator of those bits? And what are your rights if you, let's say, are the consumers of those bits? So that's going to be something really interesting. And then, of course, as a sarcastic comment, I might say, does security really work, or does it just make us feel good? And that's something we could talk about, you know, as we go along. If you think about what does one want, let's say, if I own content, what do I might want to do with this? And let me put it in the context generically, let's say, of video. Oh, this would also apply to audio, and to a certain extent images, but the wording would be a little bit different. I probably would like to do things like access control. In other words, who can access my content? So in some cases, this is maybe a cryptography problem. But in other words, what rights do I give people to have the ability to access my content? And then you could layer that in with things that are generically called copy control. So do you have the right to play something back? Do you have the right to record it? And let's say even things like generation control, do you have the right to make a copy of a copy? So these are types of things that rights that owners might give to you as you're sort of consuming this content. I might also like to do things like auditing. So this would be an example of who did what and when. Okay, and I'll give you some examples of this a little bit later when we move through the talk, probably an example that maybe you weren't aware of. Now, what do users want? Now, users should have the ability to do time shifting. In other words, you should have the ability to watch something, here again, generically, think in terms of video, watch something later that maybe was broadcast today. In other words, watch the Super Bowl tonight, even though it was broadcast a month or so ago. You should also have the right to do things like format shifting. In other words, you should have the right to maybe take content, some digital content you buy legally, and then change the format of that content so you can use it in a different way. So, for example, you should have the right to buy a CD and rip it to MP3 so you can put it in a portable MP3 player and play the content. Or maybe you should have the right to buy a DVD and maybe be able to make a reduced resolution version of it and put it on your computer so you can watch it. Okay. Now, some people say you should have the right to back up your content. I think that's somewhat bogus. However, one of the things I say that you should not have the right to do, and that is say that if the owner doesn't, if I don't agree with the way the owner distributes the content or the method in which he distributes the content, I don't have the right to steal it. Okay? This is the argument I hear about people saying about using file sharing. I only want the one song. Okay? Or I only want, it's not quite the format I want, so therefore I should have a right to go out and get it. Now, if that's what you believe, then that also implies you feel you should have the right to just go to the record store and steal it. So if you feel comfortable with doing file sharing without paying for it, then I encourage you to go to a local record store here in Austin and steal it. Now, the reason why you don't do that is one simple reason. Okay, it's because you know you have a better chance of getting caught by stealing the record as opposed to stealing the MP3 file. Okay, and independent of morality, your likelihood of getting caught in some cases drives your morals. Now, you can also make other arguments. I've heard arguments say, well, it's a big company. I should have the right to take the content. Now, when I'm in Europe, I hear, it's a big American company. I should have a right to take the content. Okay? So I don't agree with this, but I do agree that you should have certain rights. Okay? And I'll say something a little bit more about that in a second. Now, one of the things that we're looking at here is that a law, something called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and it's very controversial, and I think parts of it might be ruled unconstitutional. And there's some aspects of it that worry me. So one is that if you remove a security feature from a data element, are you breaking the law? Okay. And I go both ways on this. Okay. I will tell you, one of the things that bothers me the most is that it appears that people are using this law to make reverse engineering illegal.
Now, this country has had a long history of allowing reverse engineering. So what's a classical example of reverse engineering? Ford goes out and buys a Chevrolet, and they take it apart and see how it's manufactured. Now, technically, that is not illegal. However, if you buy a piece of software and you take the software apart, okay, technically people have already said that's illegal. That violates the DMCA, which I don't agree with. I think reverse engineering is really important, and I don't know, Ted, you're shaking your head, so I assume maybe you agree with it. I don't know. Okay, another interesting thing is what? Yeah.
Now, isn't it because like physical things like what might be a car typically protected by patents, the software designs may not be...
Some software designs are protected by patents.
It can be,
yeah. And so I think the issue of reverse engineering, I mean, I'm willing to listen to arguments about it, but it worries me that people are using this concept to make reverse engineering illegal. Okay? The other issue is what constitutes distribution. So, for instance, I go out and buy a textbook. So I go out and buy Professor Rappaport's book. Now, I can buy that book, and I can give it to Professor Bovic here, and I haven't violated the law. As a matter of fact, I can buy Professor Rappaport's book, and I can charge Professor Bovic more for it. In other words, make a profit if he's itty enough to buy it from me. And since I've known him for 20 years, I know he will.
I'll give it to you free.
And that still is legal, okay? Now, the problem is, what does it mean if I say I want to take an MP3 file and give it to Professor Bovic? Should I be allowed to do that? Now, if you extend that concept, does that mean I should also be able to deliver it to my 10,000 closest best friends? Okay? So there's a problem here about what's going to constitute distribution. Okay? And I'm telling you, I see some students here. Companies that I talk to are beginning to worry about you guys, about your morals. Because I'm hearing companies say, if they'll steal MP3 files, why won't they take the intellectual property that we own in this company and distribute it? Okay? I was talking to a senior vice president from a microprocessor company that I won't name, but whose first letter is a big I. And he said to me, look it, we have a lot of important things around here. And if the attitude of people we're hiring is that bits should be free, if bits become free, we go out of business pretty quickly. Okay? So I know that some companies are tracking people that are using this type of stuff, and in some cases they may not want to hire them. I will also tell you this, in case you guys don't know, the Motion Picture Association of America is shopping around for a university to sue, okay, on file sharing. Yes. And I'll tell you right now, to tell the students, if this university gets sued, this place will roll over on you faster than you can turn the lights off. Because I'm sure they don't have lots of money around here to protect you in a lawsuit. Okay. And I think it's going to happen because about 2 weeks ago, Jack Valenti, the president of the MPAA, gave a speech at Duke University where he basically warned universities that he's getting tired of universities giving students access to broadband so they can use it mainly to steal content. Okay. And I know at my university, after about 10 o'clock at night, if you look at the outbound connections, they're all going off the file share and recollecting the statistics. So I think this is going to be a problem. Now, if you look at kind of a classical model of any digital communication system, and this is 53 years old, this block diagram. And how do I know this? Because this block diagram was published in the same year that I was born. Okay. This diagram originally, actually a modified version of it, appeared in a paper called The Mathematical Theory of Communication by a guy named Claude Shannon. He was kind of a stringy, tall, little thin kid from Petoskey, Michigan, who went off and did some interesting things. But what's interesting about this, does your students know about Claude? What's interesting about this is that
the picture of him on our lab door.
Oh, you do? I thought it was a picture of you.
He was the 1 millionth visitor to Slim National Park, and that's why the picture was
there. Really? I actually met him. He was a very interesting guy. Okay. Why I'm putting this up is that, and I don't have time to go through all of this, but you have the classical source encoder, channel decoder, source encoder. The encryption and decryption or security features go after the source encoder, before the channel encoder, because you want the input here to have minimal statistical redundancy. If it doesn't have minimal physical redundancy, that's a way you can attack the security system. Why I'm mentioning this is that in many cases for multimedia systems, the security features are being inserted here. And this is theoretically bad. But we've done some of this stuff too. And you can get into some trouble here, and actually you should do it here, but there's sometimes reasons why you can't put the security features after the data compression. And many of those are practical reasons, they're not theoretical. Okay. If you look at a typical cryptographic system, let's say you try to secure content, one of the problems you run into is that maybe you're not aware of it, but there's an implied trust. In other words, I'm some user here, and I'm pushing data through this insecure channel to another user, and I'm assuming maybe I have an attacker tapping this channel and trying to get the data. Well, if I use encryption on this channel, one of the things implied is that these two users, this source and user, can trust each other. So there's implied trust. Okay. Now, it turns out if they can't trust each other, then you have to do some sort of authentication. Okay. Now, what's the role of authentication? Authentication answers the question, are you who you say you are? Okay. Now, you do this with your bank, right? You authenticate yourself with your bank. I mean, when you go to the bank website, how do you know it's the bank website? And more importantly, from the bank's point of view, how does the bank know it's you? So you actually have a procedure for doing the authentication. Now, why I'm pointing this out is that this requires a backward channel to do the authentication. Okay. Now, why do you want to do the authentication? Well, you could look at it from a point of view not of you and the bank. Let's say this is a DVD player. And this DVD player wants to deliver content to something it thinks it's a TV. So the DVD player asks a secure question that says, are you a TV? And the TV says, yes, I'm a TV, deliver the content. But suppose it's not a TV, but it's a computer that says, yes, I'm a TV. Then what can happen is that computer then can take this content and let's say write it on its hard drive. Now, the issue here is then to mitigate that is you have to do authentication. How do you do that, particularly, let's say, in a consumer electronics device? How do I do that in my MP3 player? Okay? Now, you can do that in your home, let's say if you have a TiVo or a DirecTV receiver. If you want to do certain functions, particularly you want to get the password updated and a few other things, you have to take your device and either plug it into your broadband network or plug it into a telephone line. But now suppose I'm walking around and I want to do authentication. Maybe I might have, you know, some sort of a wide area network like a GPRS system or 2.5G or 3G wireless phone that I could authenticate through that. But, you know, what happens if I'm up in the bowels of Wyoming or something and I need to be able to do authentication? This is going to be a serious problem, particularly for multimedia-type devices that may not have a reliable backward channel. And every model that I've seen that has been proposed for doing this won't work because you need the true backward channel. Now, the backward channel doesn't have to be as broadband as the forward channel, but you still need a backward channel. And there could be problems when that backward channel doesn't exist. Now, if you look at media elements that people have talked about protecting, there are things like audio, video, documents, including things like HTML documents, image graphics, graphic C models, programs, executable code. All of this stuff is things that people want to protect. And the problem is that all of this stuff, to a certain extent, has to be what people say is consumed. In other words, you could say, well, I can just do encryption on all of this. That's true. But the problem is, at some point, you want to watch it, you want to listen to it. And that requires that it be decrypted. Okay? So we have a problem here. It's not like data being transferred from one spot to the other. So we have a problem because of the fact that the stuff needs to be consumed. Now, if you look at the multimedia tool set, there's encryption, authentication. And by the way, if you don't know, authentication is a special form of encryption. Then there's things like hashing and timestamping. I'm not going to have time to go into these. These hashing is a way of just taking a very long message and making it into a unique kind of short form of the message. And by timestamping, I'm not talking about changing the timestamps on the files on your computer because you know how to do this. I'm talking about what is referred to. It's got a really long fancy name. It's called a cryptographically secure third-party escrow timestamp. Now, what does that mean? That means you trust somebody else's clock. And what this means is you take something that you create, you send it off to them, they put a timestamp on it, then you can prove you created it at that date. And in many cases, for doing things like ownership,
copyright protection, time stamping might even be better than doing this before the other one is watermarking, which we'll concentrate a bit more on. If you look at the security application scenarios, you have things like privacy, that's mainly encryption, privacy detection, or forgery detection, you could use watermarking for that. Copyright protection, you could use watermarking for that. Proof of purchase, proof of delivery, these are things that are more probably authentication-based. You also want these to be non-deniable. What that means is that you don't want to pay for something that you buy over the net with your digital dollars, and then the company come back and says, oh, no, we didn't get it. Send it again. So you want to have non-deniable transactions both ways. And then things like intruder detection. This is probably more really a pattern recognition problem than anything else. Now, one of the things that's interesting to me, and one of the things I'm doing, concentrating my own research in a couple areas, is how do you do this over a wireless noisy channel? This is really kind of an important problem. And I'm not satisfied with the solutions that I've seen, and I'll say more about that as we go along. Okay, so what is watermarking? So you can say I'll give you some fancy words here. So it's the use of perceptually invisible authentication techniques. Well, what is that? What it means is what we're going to do is we're going to insert a controlled amount of distortion in some sort of media element. We're going to put noise in the signal. And we're going to do this in a way that doesn't bother you. I'm going to show you some examples. Now, visible watermarks exist. Here's my visible watermark. Okay, this is the Purdue dead bird. This is a griffin. Okay. I don't know what you have. What do you have it here? You have like a dead cow. You have a mad cow or something. Dead cow for you. So you see this on your TV where you see the little logo there on the side. So visible watermarks exist. And actually, there's been some really excellent work in visible watermarking by Fred Mitzer and his group at IBM. Okay, so here's a scenario. So let's say an owner places some digital images on the network server, and maybe let's say wants to protect it. So here's one scenario. So you'd like to verify who owns an image, let's say detect forgeries, identify illegal copies, prevent unauthorized distributions. So those are the types of things people have talked about. Now, where have watermarks been used or proposed? These are all the ones people have talked about. Things like digital cameras. The idea being is maybe you have a camera, let's say with a GPS receiver, and when you take the picture, it would also let you know where you took it at. Now, it's true, you could take that geographical information and put it in the JPEG header, but the problem with that is a lot of downline processing might actually remove it. So what we're actually doing is saying we're going to take this data and actually bind it into the actual pixels of the image. That way you won't lose it. Okay, so there's one application. Another one is in DVD video, and that's coming on. I'll say a little bit more about that maybe later. Audio, there was something called the Secure Digital Music Initiative, and that was, as I predicted, that was dead on arrival. It never worked. I predicted it 2 years before. I predicted 2 months before it started that it would die, and it took them 2 years to figure that out. They spent about $25 million in the process of doing that. Broadcast video. So, for instance, I'll give you an example where this is used in broadcast video. It turns out that probably about 80 to 90% of U.S. sports programs that are broadcast on South American television are pirated. Okay. Now, if you watch the Super Bowl, okay, the Super Bowl was watermarked. And as a matter of fact, the version of the Super Bowl you watched here in Austin was slightly different than the version of the Super Bowl I watched in Lafayette, Indiana. Because each version of the Super Bowl had a unique watermark that was inserted in the content relative to the TV station it was broadcast on. Okay? And then what happened was a company, actually a subsidiary of Philips, went to various South American countries, went to set up little hotel rooms, put computers in the hotel rooms, stick an antenna out the window, and start digitizing the content and looking for the watermark. And then when they found the watermark, they found two things: what program had been pirated and where they got it from. Okay? And then there was lots of legal issues that then took off. So this whole idea of doing broadcast monitoring is going to be done. There's other examples of this. I'm told, and I don't know that much about the whole TV commercial business, but I'm told in Germany, TV commercial people are always complaining because they'll buy a 30-second slot, and the TV station only plays 28 seconds. So what they're doing now is they're watermarking their commercials and having systems that monitor the commercials looking for the watermark to see how long the content was actually been in the images. You know, whether or not they've actually did all 29 minutes or 29 seconds to 30 seconds. So this is this whole area that's sometimes referred to as metadata binding. There's been some use of watermarking techniques for doing key distributions in cryptographic systems. Prevention of forgery of banknotes and really other types of identity documents. So in about 5 years, if you get a passport, it's going to have watermarking technology in it to get around forgery. The next generation U.S. banknotes are going to have digital watermarks in them to help minimize counterfeiting. Another really interesting problem I'm working on is this area of digital cinema and cinema-related theft. So there's this classical thing that these cinema guys refer to as a camcorder attack. So what it boils down to is somebody goes into a movie theater with a camcorder, they sneak it in, they point the camcorder at the screen, they record the movie, and then they take it and pirate it. So if you've ever seen one of these, sometimes you see people, hear people coughing, you hear kids crying, you see people getting up and going to get popcorn and all the rest of stuff. Now, there is the newer cinemas, particularly a lot of the Star Wars movies, actually have watermarks that are optically and eventually they'll be digitally embedded in the content that survived the camcorder attack. And it's really neat because there is a problem with the camcorder attack because you're going to have geometry, you may be off-axis geometry, you can even have frame dropping and things like this. This was some work that Tone Cocker did at Philips. The idea then is that when that movie pops up in Uzbekistan, you can track that movie back to the particular movie theater, and then that theater owner would be warned that they got to do a better job of preventing people bringing camcorders into the, or other types of things. These are extremely robust watermarks. You can't wash them out. You know what all those DivX tools you guys go out and steal off the internet? This stuff doesn't wash it out. Okay. And this whole idea is a plug, this idea of what I was talking about before, the analog hole. The fact of the matter is that all this content has to be consumed. You have to watch it, listen to it, whatever, which means it has to be converted back to analog. So it'd be nice if you could have some security features that were not cryptographic-based that could be carried along with the content as it maybe was converted to analog and maybe even re-digitized. What they're doing is they're using something analogous to spread spectrum techniques. And I'll show you an example of one. Okay, so very, very robust, and they're also doing things having to do with resynchronization, which I'll come to in a second. Okay. Steganography is related to watermarking. This whole idea of watermarking, data hiding, steganography, they're all very similar, although the application domains are different. This is a Greek word, steganos, which means covered writing. It's a technique used to hide information within other information and to conceal the existence of the message. This is a hot area. It's very much related. It is part of the watermarking technology group. It's a hot area now because there's people who believe there's been some evidence that terrorist groups have used steganography techniques to hide messages. Okay. Now, to give an example, I'll give you a quick example of steganography. I'll give you the 3,000-year-old steganography example. So the Greek general Herodotus needed to send a message to one of his other generals. So he took his messenger and shaved the guy's head, tattooed the message on the guy's scalp, let the hair grow, and then sent the guy on his way. Then when he got to the other side, they shaved his head and they read the message. Very low bandwidth channel. So how many bits per hertz is that? Pretty low, right?
They count the image of the leg lost hair growth?
Yeah, they counted all of that. Yeah, so, all right. But anyway, that's a true story. So that's an example of steganography, and actually I'll show you another perhaps more relevant thing. Please go along. Okay, so here again is, if you want to introduce this distortion into the image, I'm going to show you some examples. So you can do this either in, and actually don't worry about visible watermarks, you can either do this in the transform domain like waveless or DCTs, or you can do this in the spatial domain. I'm sort of talking, this would apply to audio, video, or images. If you generically look at it, it's an image processing problem. So you have an original image, you have a watermark, you have a watermarking algorithm, and then you have the watermark image. So what are these things? So this watermark is generated. And here again, I don't have a time to go into a lot of detail, but either this can be related directly to the message you want to hide, or it can be maybe something that indexes the message to an owner. So, for instance, one scenario would be is that maybe each owner would have a unique key that they feed into a random number generator. That then generates a random set of, like a watermark type thing, and I'll show you an example of that. Then you have a marking algorithm that essentially incorporates this watermark in the image, and then you have a verification algorithm. Okay. Now, the goal for these invisible watermarks is you don't see them. Okay. So this becomes a problem. As a matter of fact, you can model watermarking in your steganography as a channel coding problem with side information. So it's a digital communications problem. Now, as you know, in digital communications problems, there's two things you worry about. Well, there's more than two things, but there's basically two things. One thing you worry about is things like, let's say, probability of bit error. Okay. And the other thing that you worry about is probability bit error and synchronization. Okay, I'm going to talk about synchronization in a second. If you think about it, what's one way, if you think about this, a simple way in a digital communication system, to decrease your probability of bit error is to what? How about increasing the power of the transmitted signal? Okay. Now think about it in the context of this problem. What is the signal and what is the noise? In this case, the signal is the watermark. What's the noise? The image. And it has orders of magnitude more energy than the signal. This is a classical weak signal detection problem. Now, one way to fix this is jack up the power in the noise. In other words, jack up the power in the watermark. If you jack up the power in the watermark, you're going to increase the likelihood you're going to see the watermark in the image. I'll show you an example of this. So this is a trade-off between detectability and visibility. And in the watermarking business, this is called post-signal interference. Now, synchronization, I'll just give you a quick thing on synchronization, I'm going to come back to it. If those of you that maybe done any reading in watermarking, you'll hear stories about how it's easy to remove the watermark out of the picture. No, you can't remove the watermark out of the picture. What you effectively do is you desynchronize the watermark from the detector. Now, there are all kinds of ways of doing resynchronization. I got a big research project on watermark resynchronization. But it is, for all practical purposes, a classical digital communication problem. Bit error rates, false alarm detection, and synchronization is all there. And it is a classical weak signal detection problem. There's also issues about, do you need the original image to do the detection? And if you think about this in some scenarios, let's say you're delivering images over the web, you don't want to have the original image. If you don't need the original image, this is called blind detection. And then you can use models of public key and private key cryptography. And I'm not gonna go into any detail. Let me come back to that. Okay, here's the principles. Transparency. So this is the trade-off between detectability and visibility. Then there's robustness to attack. Can I take the image and do some sort of processing toward the video or audio or whatever? And then, essentially, I, quote, remove the watermark, but really what I usually end up doing is desynchronizing the watermark. Now, in some cases, you think, well, I'd like to have this watermark be very robust. But in other cases, you don't. You want the watermark to become fragile. In other words, what this means is you do any processing to the picture, and the watermark is immediately desynchronized. And then you can immediately know that somebody did something to the picture. Okay, so fragile watermarking is important for doing things like forensics. And then there's capacity. It's a classical Shannon theory problem. How many damn bits can you put in the image? Okay. And guys like Pierre Milan at the University of Illinois have been looking at this problem. You know, can you derive a channel capacity theorem for watermarking? And the answer is yes. However, it's a classical Shannon problem. You get all these nice capacity arguments, but there's no insight into how in the hell you do the watermarking. I mean, so it's a classical problem. Okay, so I mentioned the fragile stuff. Attacks that people have talked about are doing things like, this is for images, compression, filtering, printing, scanning. This is a classical thing of taking the content, taking it from the digital domain to the analog domain, back to the digital domain. This is like an analog attack. And I'm going to show you the next watermark I'm going to show you will survive. You can take this image, you can print it, you can rescan it, and the watermark is still in the image. Okay? Things like cropping, collusion, this is more for video and conversion to analog. So let me show you, I think the next slide talks about this. Yeah, so this is kind of the classical Ingemar Cox spread spectrum of watermarking algorithm that won a best paper award in the IEEE transactions on image processing. So here's how it works, and I'm going to boiling it down to make it simple. So let's assume that the watermark is just a sequence of random numbers. It could either be a bipolar binary sequence or a zero mean univariance Gaussian. I don't care. Let's let X be the original image and Y be the watermark image, and we're going to assume that we take the discrete cosine transform of both of these images. Now, if you don't know what the discrete cosine transform is, it's the transform that's used in JPEG and MPEG. And although in here, we're not going to do it block-based. We're going to do the entire image. Okay. So then what we're going to do is we have a scaling factor A, and so we take, we weight the watermark by that, add 1 to it, multiply the DCT coefficient. We take the inverse DCT of this, and that's the watermark image. Now, if you analyze this, this is analogous to taking the watermark in the spatial domain and spreading it throughout the image. And you can use spread spectrum models for analyzing this, and Cox did in his original paper. If you want the reference, I can give it to you. Okay. Now, this watermark has one problem, and that is the watermark is not blind. So what you do is if you have an image and you want to test whether or not the watermark is in it, you essentially dump it back into this equation, and you find an estimate of what you think the watermark is, and then you compute this test statistic, which is nothing more than taking the two watermarks and projecting them onto each other and looking at the projected values. And then you threshold this. So it's like a classical correlation-based detector. Okay, so, and by the way, you can look at correlation-based detectors that have been used in spread spectrum for a long time. So it has that same type of model associated with it. Okay, here's an example. So this is an original picture. This is my stepdaughter, Tia. And there's Tia with a watermark. And so what I'm going to do is, in that equation, I'm going to jack up the value of A so then you can start seeing the watermark. So now I'm going to multiply by factor 5. Now, if you look, both Tia's legs, her arms, head, you can start seeing the watermark. But what's interesting is that you don't see the watermark, particularly from the back, you don't see the watermark in this area here. So this immediately suggests that maybe I could differentially embed the watermark. In other words, maybe I've embedded in areas with higher energy in places you can't see, and then lower energy in places you can see. Then maybe when I average the energy in the watermark, it's higher than I would normally embed. Okay, here's even more. Okay, and here's even more. Now, you agree the detection of this watermark is trivial, right? So I got great detection here. Now, the image is not worth anything. By the way, this watermark is also robust, is it not? Because I can filter the hell out of this image, and I'm still probably going to see the watermark. Okay. I mean, this version of it. Now, it turns out, even at this level, I can take this image, and I can print it, and I can rescan it, and I can still extract the watermark. Okay. This watermark's very robust. Now, can I also break it? Yeah, I can show you how to break it, too. Okay. But it is a relatively robust watermark. Here's an example of staying on. How long do we have? Like you told, roughly a little bit before 4 o'clock or something?
No.
You didn't pay me that much. As long as I want, crap. All right, now. This image. Well, sure. Come on, Jay, give me a break. All right, now. This image has this message embedded in it. So this is a test message demonstrating the S-Tool 4.0 steganography software. So this is the original image. This is the image that has the message embedded in it. If you look up close, you could see some noise along the edges and things like that. But if I just gave you this image, you would not be able to tell there was a message in it. Now, how this is embedded is even easier than the other one. What is done here is these images, the message is embedded by twiddling the least significant bit in each one of the pixels. So this would be easy to get the message out. Just dither out all the low-order bits. Okay. Now, the whole idea of one of the really interesting research areas is something called Steg analysis. In the Steg analysis, you answer three questions. You try to answer three questions. Does this image have a message in it? What technology was used to embed it? And can you extract the message? Now, in some cases, the last question is very difficult. But the first two questions can be solved. There's been a lot of work in this area. Now, the reason why I showed this message, this particular tool, is this tool was used to commit a crime. Okay. And unfortunately for that criminal, the U.S. Justice Department asked me to be the expert witness. So that guy is now doing 5 years in the federal penitentiary. So don't commit a crime with watermarking. I may come after you. Okay. My research efforts. This is the stuff we're doing in kind of multimedia security at Purdue, and I'll show you some examples. Doing work in robust image adaptive watermarks, I'll show you some examples of this, and fragile and semi-fragile watermarks for forensic testing. I'll show you some examples of video, robust video watermark. Not some examples, but I'll actually tell you what we're doing. We're also doing a lot of work in digital cinema, looking at this camcorder attack, particularly doing this resynchronization from geometric distortion type stuff. I have a big project, the National Infrastructure Testbed on watermark evaluation is in my laboratory at Purdue. It's funded by the Air Force. And so if you want to test watermarking algorithms, very shortly you'll be able to come to a website at Purdue. You can test watermarking techniques. We have a NSF ITR program. I'm looking at document protection and forensic analysis. And to be cynical, what we're basically doing is we've built a printer that can spy on you. Okay. The other thing I'm interested in is error-resilient cryptography, and I didn't get a chance to really talk about this. One of the problems with cryptography, similar to watermarking, is there's implied synchronization in cryptography. And you can run into problems, particularly in wireless channels where you get total disconnection of data. You can run into problems of resynchronization. And so we're looking at error-resilient. We've got a new project. We're starting looking at error-resilient cryptography. And I don't really know where it's going to go because at one level, error-resilient cryptography is an oxymoron. Because if it's error-resilient, that also means maybe it can be attacked. So I got a PhD student working on this. And we're having some really great arguments. And we're working on a lot of things looking at consumer electronics devices. So let me show you some examples. This is some stuff we did with Bell Labs, Chris Polachuk at Bell Labs. And this was an image adaptive watermark. We actually, here's the image, and here's the watermarked image. And here's the watermark. And what we did is we differentially embedded it. So it looks better there than here. But in regions up here where you would notice any modifications, we didn't embed the watermark with very high energy. But along the edges, where these little ragged edges, it doesn't bother you much. We jacked the embedding up. Now, what this did is, on average, it made the watermark have a higher intensity, which meant to make it more robust. Okay. So there's one example. This is another example. Here again, we didn't embed it with much energy in the skin, much more in the hair, and not much in the background. And here again, they look better over here. One of the nice things that Chris did with this piece of work is she extended the human visual system models to the wavelet domain, which hadn't been done yet. And that paper appeared in the Journal of Select Area Communication, a special issue on watermarking. Here again, some differential. And here it's hard to see, but here again, along the, like in the top of the pepper where the little texture is, we can put more energy in the watermark than we could before. Here's another example of a watermark. This is the Tia picture again. Now, this is a fragile or semi-fragile watermark. This is actually a patent we just had recently get issued. This watermark, we can make it be fragile so that if you make any changes to the image, we can immediately detect and localize the changes. It also can be semi-fragile, which means we can allow a little bit of processing to the image, let's say, which would be done effectively by, like, say, your web browser or something like that, which is going to do resizing and some other things. Here's another forensic application we worked on. Here what we did is we took these two kids and we exchanged their lips, and we changed the background, and then given this image with some watermarking structure in there, we detected where all the changes were. Okay? So there were some false alarms. Make sure you understand the detector did not have any knowledge of the original image. It just had knowledge of the watermark structure that was embedded in this image and also that image. And so this was a relatively nice forensic tool for doing this. And this is actually the jumping off point of that other project that I think we talked about after lunch. One of the other things we're looking at is video watermarking. This is a project that's being funded by a company called Digimark. What we're doing is, in a sense, it's really a watermarking protocol. One of the problems you can run into, let's say, with these resynchronization problems, is that if you have a video that's watermarked, you just take two frames and interchange them, the watermark can be desynchronized, okay? Or if you take something inserted between two frames. Now, you guys know the story about the Who Framed Roger Rabbit attack, right? The Disney thing?
Better tell it.
All right. There's a process when you convert a film to video. It's called telecine. And in the telecine that was done for the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit when the DVD was being made, the telecine operator inserted a frame in the video that was not in the movie. You guys know the story? Nobody knows? Well, the frame that was inserted was a picture of Jessica Rabbit that was anatomically correct, and Jessica had no clothes on. And it was discovered by a four-year-old kid that was watching the movie and single-stepping through. And by that time, over 25,000 copies of the movie had been sold. And Disney had to recover them all. Now, if they had watermarked the movie, I mean, this is not good if you have children. I mean, I have a 20-year-old who probably would think it's a joke. But some of you might have younger children. One of the things that movie theaters are doing is that they farm out, or not movie, but movie companies, or they farm out a lot of this work. And one of the things I'm working on with them, particularly Technicolor, is when the stuff comes back, how do you know the integrity of it? In other words, could some guy make another statement that was even stronger than this? Okay. And Disney, you know, went nuts about this, and there was all kinds of problems. The person was found. Okay, so we're interested in looking at these so-called resynchronization attacks. And what we've done here is really interesting. What comes out of this device here is what we call a key generator. And what this key generator does is it generates keys that tells this watermark generator what watermark to embed in each frame. And it's very unique because one of the things that you can show is that watermark content, the watermark is going to be much more robust if it's dependent upon the content. Those image adaptive ones are an example of that. So we actually have a frame analyzer that analyzes what's going on in the frame, extracts features, and then dumps this into a finite state machine. Now, the particular finite state machine we're using here is a cryptographically secure finite state machine. It's based on the AES encryption algorithm. Now, if you study encryption, you can model most encryption processes being nonlinear finite state machines. So we have an extremely secure finite state machine that then drives a so-called redundancy control, and then from there it determines the watermark. Here again, I can point to references, papers we have. This is one of my students' doctoral dissertation. Okay, so this is basically how the embedder works, and we're really kind of agnostic as to how you actually do the embedding. But the most important part is how do you do this insertion. Here's the actually detection. So what does this show? Well, we've shown, theoretically with this system, practically, that you can take any two frames in our watermark sequence and insert a frame, insert anywhere from one to an infinite number of frames, and we can recover the watermark. Now, for an infinite number of frames, you've got to wait a while. Okay? But we can recover the watermark. If you take 20% of the frames and randomly transpose them, we can recover the watermark. If you take 20% of the frames and average them and replace the frame with an average of two of the frames, we can still recover the watermark. It's extremely robust and extremely secure. As a matter of fact, my student Eugene Lin made a calculation as far as breaking this this device here. Okay, so if you use a 1 gigahertz processor, I know we have 3 gigahertz processors. Use a 1 gigahertz processor, and you can search through 10,000 keys per second, which we don't think you can do. But if you can do 10,000 keys per second, it will take you 10 to the 27th century to be able to recover this key sequence. Okay. So we think it's reasonably secure. Now we got to do some more analysis to be able to show that. Okay, I think I'm almost done. Yes, I'm done. Okay, so I think the secure multimedia system is evolving. Simple add-ons. You know, data security guys coming to work on this problem usually don't last very long. Okay, you got to know something about the nature of the content. All right, you got to be able to exploit the unique nature of the data type. Let me jump down here. You also need techniques that will tolerate changes to the images and are compatible with compression, because every one of these media types, audio, video, images, are going to be compressed. Okay, I think that watermarking is going to be crucial. I'll say something on the next slide. Time stamp, I support, but I didn't get a chance to say anything about that. I think there are interesting research areas, but you know, where there'll be significant theoretical developments. Pierre Milan was here, he would say yes. I would say to Pierre, yes, it's really neat, but we need some practical watermarking algorithms. Shannon-like theorems are really neat. I'm a math hacker like anybody else, but at some point I got to put bits in pictures, and I need insight into that. Here's a sarcastic comment. I mean, I could give another talk that would tell you everything that's wrong about watermarking. So that's why I say, is watermarking a feel-good technology or multimedia? The answer to the question, I don't know. However, I will say this. I believe that within 5 years, every piece of video or audio or images or TV that you watch that you didn't author will be watermarked. I believe that. I'm done. I'll be more than happy to answer some questions. Yes?
In some sense, doesn't the improvement in compression technology compete with watermarks? Because if a compression technology, as it approaches the Shannon limit, that is, it approaches the minimum, the most efficient encoding, and especially if it optimizes for human perception,
right,
you're removing information that you can't see.
Yeah, but
so you're
but that ain't going to happen for a while because all of these techniques. If you look at the bit streams, let's say JPEG 2000, JPEG, MPEG, there's still a lot of redundancy in those bit streams.
Okay.
And I think that there's always going to be ways of modifying that stuff in a way that you won't be able to see it. I mean, if you're in an ideal system, you might have trouble doing this. But the problem is comparison. In other words, suppose you did that. All right, so then I add my stuff to this. I go ahead and I watermark it even after you compress it. Then what you get is a slightly noisy version of the original, but you never see the original. So you don't know what you got. In other words, what I'm going to do is I'm going to deliver content to you where you effectively have never seen the original. So you don't know how good the original is.
In a practical sense, does it mean you have to do new watermarking algorithms every time you have a new compression algorithm?
No, I've not seen that yet.
Are you working only at the original image level so far?
We're doing both. We're watermarking and the compressed domain.
Okay.
But I think that you really the fact of the matter is, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the classical example of this is that you never see the first contact print of a movie. In other words, the movie is shot, and it's shot on negative film. One contact print is made of that. And then what you effectively see is two or three prints from that when you go to a movie theater. So, and the same thing is true. You've never seen true CCIR 601 digital video. And so, if you've never seen that, then if we give you a version that maybe has a little bit of noise in it, but still is pretty good, you're going to still be impressed. So even if I take the stuff all the way down to the limit, I'll just add a little bit of junk to the image. And you'll still think it's great, because you won't be able to do A-B comparison. We watermark HDTV all the time, and it still looks pretty good. So the issue is whether or not, the real issue is whether or not you can see it. But your argument is, I think, is the other way. That is, if I watermark the content and I compress it, the compression will strip out the watermark. But all I got to do is stick the watermark in after I do the compression. You know, twiddle with the DCT coefficients or twiddle with the wavelength coefficients. Don't put it in the motion vectors. That's bad. Don't put watermarking in the motion vectors. But all I got to do is just add it up. All that's going to do is noise the picture up a little bit. You won't be able to tell it. Particularly if you have uncalibrated PDs and things like that. What?
And I just want you to speculate.
Oh my God. Okay, what am I speculating on?
Well, as you know, we've been looking at image quality assessment.
Yes.
And it seems to me that somewhere there should be some place where these two things may.
Oh yeah, I'm very interested. As a matter of fact, in my watermarking test bed, I have a hole on there for doing watermarking quality assessment. And that's why I'm interested in your tools. So if you could get your tools up and running, I'd be more than happy. Maybe we can even write a proposal together, at least author some papers together on using your tools on watermarking.
Cool.
I mean, I think it's important.
That's the answer.
But I will tell you this. And we've looked at a lot of pictures, and less so with video, and there's some practical reasons. The artifacts are totally different than compression artifacts. Even these blurs that we looked at in your lab for this JPEG 2000 stuff, the watermarking artifacts are different. They're not blurred out like that. You can get things that, in a sense, are like pseudo-blockiness type things. Because particularly if you stick a watermark in after you do the compression. And then there's other things you do. For instance, if you're going to watermark in the JPEG 2000 domain, You pull out the wavelet coefficient, you ask yourself the question, should I stick the watermark in this wavelet coefficient? And the first question you got to ask yourself is, does that increase the rate? And the answer is yes, then you don't watermark that coefficient because you try to not to do any rate extension on yourself.
What about the other question of, as you increase the power of the watermark, it becomes more visible.
Right.
It tends to affect the quality of the image, which is very difficult to quantify.
Oh, that'd be another one. A good example of this is, in some cases, I went to the so-called golden eyes test of the DVD watermark for the Motion Picture Association of America. I represented Thompson Multimedia. And one of the problems they had is they were given a spec on a particular false alarm rate that needed to be met. To meet that false alarm rate, they all had to jack up the power in their watermark. And it turned out when you watched the video, it looked like you were watching the video through a dirty window. That's the way the watermark, it's called the dirty window effect. And that's the way the watermark manifested itself. It would be nice if there would be some way of predicting when this effect would turn on. You know, how much can I jack up the power, or what can I do as far as driving down the false alarm rate before this dirty window effect? And but that also requires that you're going to have to do some sort of temporal masking models too, which are, as you know, are very difficult. I mean, I'm not happy with any of the temporal masking models that we've seen. So I maybe you have one that I'm not aware of, but I'm not. So, any other questions? Okay, if you want to know more about this, you can go to my website. There's a couple of tutorial papers, and I'd be more than happy to talk with you privately or whatever. So, thanks for coming.